This is Angle of View. Today is March 24th, 2026. I'm Will Hatman. Well, another Oscars has hit the books, and because my personal life is presently careering between windstorms, my best means to a show this week is to pick through last Sunday night's winners and offer up my 2 cents on each one, in sequence, as though I had been posting through it, which I'm very glad I was not, because I think I would have made some enemies if I had shared these thoughts spontaneously and in real time, rather than giving them a week to boil down. I'm not going to review the telecast, which was mostly very awkward. I honestly can't remember another year when more of the presenters' bits fell apart so totally and resulted in so much flailing. Although the best joke of the whole evening was the very first one out of the mouth of Conan O'Brien, I'm honored to be the last human host of the Academy Awards. That's pretty good. But here I go sounding like someone reviewing the telecast. It was a mixed bag of honorees, but I'm honestly at least content with most of the big winners, as well as with the nominees that came up empty. I've been saying lately how funny it is the way Marty Supreme fell off the world after 3 weeks of blinding hype last December, and I'm honestly not surprised that it ended up the most nominated of the night's movies to go home with nothing, 0-9. Everybody forgot about that movie, myself included, and the red-hot revival of discourse around Sinners and One Battle After Another in the run-up to the show was the funniest proof of this. Nobody made room in any of that for even a whisper about Marty Supreme or about Timothée Chalamet as possible dark horses. It's just gone. Although, just to keep you on your toes, I will tell you that I honestly probably would have voted for it in at least 2 and possibly as many as 4 of the craft categories that it was nominated in, and I think the actual winners in 3 of those categories were among the night's worst injustices. Meanwhile, those 2 undyingly huge movies, the movies that will define 2025 forever, were both released by Warner Brothers, which is soon to be digested by the Ellison's fascist globe-spanning data mining surveillance AI culture replacement enterprise. So maybe hosting isn't the only aspect of the show whose human qualities are set to expire next year. Anyway, that's enough of me being oblique. This is already a long enough show. Let's hit it square in the center. Here are the winners in each category in broadcast order. Best Supporting Actress, Amy Madigan in Weapons. What a treat this was. And all the more after the show's opening bit, Conan dressed up as Madigan's character in Weapons, the witch villain Gladys, reminded us that Gladys will almost certainly be remembered as one of the iconic movie characters of 2025. Best Supporting Actress was one of the best fields of nominees of the entire night, as it was one of the few in which none of the performances nominated nor any of the movies containing the performances were bad. But as I continue to believe that Zach Cregger's nasty little horror comedy was a 2025 highlight and a better film than Sinners, Sentimental Value, or One Battle After Another, the other movies on this slate, it delights me that it won in the single category in which it was honored with a nomination. Madigan's speech was also the best kind, totally candid and earnest in a way that is only possible when the winner's truly surprised. I had not realized that she was nominated once before, exactly 40 years earlier, and though I haven't seen Twice in a Lifetime from 1985, it turns out that even before notching this win, Madigan had already made history for being the actress with the longest gap between Oscar nominations. Since you're wondering, as I was, yes, the record gap for a male actor is bigger. It was 41 years between nominations for both Judd Hirsch and Henry Fonda. Best Animated Feature, K-Pop Demon Hunters. I am only partly qualified to comment on this win because this is the only one of the 5 movies nominated in this category that I've seen, and it took me until after the show to put it on. It's cute, sure, but it's really flat, both in its look and its arc. The characters are so wooden in their design that it's off-putting, and the story never gets anywhere near strong feelings. But it was a phenomenon in a way that none of the other 4 nominees can claim to have been, because it has K-pop in the title, and the songs are pretty good examples of the genre. Best Animated Short, The Girl Who Cried Pearls. If you listened to the last show, you already know how much I hated this short, in which children living in abject, soul-frying poverty seem to experience something magical, which we later find out is just a lie that one of the children made up to trick somebody, and which he kept alive when he grew up to be the old man narrating the movie to his granddaughter. So we learn the value of a good lie, when the person you're deceiving is a bad guy, or is your granddaughter, I guess. And we get to learn this via a point of view that commits so totally to playing dumb that in every important way the movie passes off the lie as though it were true, only to pull the rug out at the end and then ask you why you were dumb enough to believe it or care. While you are put through this, you can feast your eyes on a cast of clay characters so splotchy and miserable that they look like Egon Schiele's worst nightmare. This wasn't at all a good field, but I would have given the statuette to Retirement Plan, which was the only nominee with any charm. Best Costume Design, Kate Hawley for Frankenstein. The problem here is that Frankenstein won anything. Heroic a spokesman for film Guillermo del Toro may be, but among the makers of films, he's one of the worst, and his child-minded, pre-digested Frankenstein is a crime against the book, which is why it was funny that Kate Hawley ended her speech by thanking Mary Shelley for the story. Del Toro showed what he really thought of Shelley's story when he hurled it into the garbage can. I thought the costumes in the film were just as glossy and untactile as everything else in it, and that apart from Avatar Fire and Ash, where does it even count as clothes, Frankenstein was the worst nominee on the slate. I would have given this one to Miyako Bellizzi for Marty Supreme, but would have been fine if it had gone to Ruth E. Carter for Sinners, which is who I had picked to win. This and the next category were the craft awards that Sinners deserved the most. And spoiler alert, the one that it eventually won for was the one it deserved the least. Best Makeup and Hairstyling, team led by Mike Hill, Jordan Samuel, and Cleona Fury for Frankenstein. Of course. This win surely owes itself to the fact that Mia Goth's look in the movie was elaborate, which accords perfectly with the toddler age level on which Academy voters seem to bestow recognition. Shiniest object wins. This one should have gone to Sinners, primarily on the basis of what happens to Omar Miller's face. Though I say this as someone who didn't see two of these five nominees at all, so I should probably just move on. Best Casting, Cassandra Koulikoundis for One Battle After Another. There was a sweet touch to the presentation of this new award. Each nominee's little puff intro was spoken by one of the actors that the nominated casting director had hired for the film for which they were nominated. So each of them was offering not just praise, but their personal thanks. Cute. Also, every nominee in this category's inaugural field was good. Even Nina Gold's work on Hamnet. I can't pretend that casting was among Hamnet's problems. But Cassandra Koulikoundis winning for One Battle After Another made for one of the evening's few cases where the winner was precisely who I was expecting and who I was rooting for. In this case, primarily for introducing us all to Chase Infinity, who, by the way, was the cast member selected to read her piece, and who got to say, "Thanks for giving me a career." I would have been equally happy to see Francine Maisler win for bringing us Miles Caton in Sinners, who among young green actors was the year's other great discovery. But since this is one area in which I begrudge neither of the year's two biggest movies even a shred, let's just focus on the idea that the continual outpouring of love for both films' supporting casts is an ongoing tribute to both of these casting talents. But let's consider this as well, since this was the first year of this category's existence and therefore the nominations were probably referenda on their whole careers to date. Cassandra Koulikoundis, whose name will now live forever, has worked with Paul Thomas Anderson on every one of his movies, first as an intern in the casting department, and then beginning with Magnolia at the head of that department. This is the kind of realization that makes a person wonder whether there has ever been a casting error anywhere in Anderson's filmography. I'm inclined to think no, and I think that's doubly remarkable for a filmmaker whose casts have been packed with so many surprises. Who could have dreamed up Adam Sandler for Punch Drunk Love, or Joanna Newsom for Inherent Vice? I admit I don't think much of Cooper Hoffman in general, at least not yet, but Licorice Pizza also gave us Alana Haim in her first movie role, and what would that movie have been without her? I also have never liked Paul Dano in anything, but the casting of Daniel Day-Lewis in There Will Be Blood is what cemented his name in the GOAT conversation, and his performance in Phantom Thread is even better. And speaking of that one, who discovered Vicky Creeps? Anderson's movies are constructed around his casts, and it's because the Academy created this category that I now realize how vital Cassandra Koulikoundis has been to his work. I kind of love the way this worked out. Best live-action short, tie between The Singers and Two People Exchanging Saliva. Well, the fact that there was a tie is interesting, at least. There hasn't been one of those since 13 years ago, when Skyfall and Zero Dark Thirty tied in the category that was then called Best Sound Editing. Also, The Singers was not exactly good, but the least bad of the five films nominated in this rancid field in 2025, so that's worth something. Two People Exchanging Saliva, on the other hand, was terrible. If you listen to the last show, this was the Bunuelian dystopian satire where sex is inverted in some ways but not in others, and money is now slapping, and nothing adds up to any kind of picture of any social anything. It's the movie version of the "it's not clear what kind of move I was trying to do" meme. The Singers team accepted their award by saying how inspiring it was to work with non-actors and that the movie is a reminder of the importance of community. It was nice. The Two People Exchanging Saliva team accepted their award by saying, "Thank you for voting for a movie that was weird and queer and made by a majority of women." I don't want to spend too much time unpacking this, but okay, sure, the movie is weird, and it is queer insofar as the central romance, if we can refer to something so lifeless as a romance, is between two women, and this queerness is clearly supposed to be a load-bearing fact, because in the world of the film, all love is forbidden. But neither the queerness nor the weirdness surrounding it succeeds in creating any resonance. The forbiddenness of love in this society doesn't make any sense, because the movie makes no effort to explain how and why there are still marriages and family units, and what they now mean, and what cultural forces now govern reproduction. Are we supposed to forget about that? I think the voters did. We are deep into a cultural phase in which we reward work on the basis of what it attempts, never mind what it achieves. We seem to think it would be rude to criticize any work of art for any reason because each is someone's personal expression and this is meant to endow it with a kind of innocent perfection, like the kind a baby has. But we are supposed to be adults. Best Supporting Actor, Sean Penn in One Battle After Another. Oof, this one hurts. And not just because Sean Penn is a famously sucky guy, but because his performance was the only bad one in One Battle After Another. Just for the record, it is bad in ways that Cassandra Koulikoundis is not to blame for. And the only bad one in this field of five nominees. I only dislike Penn's wind-up toy performance in this movie more and more as it settles in my mind. I would have given this award either to Benicio del Toro for his infinitely better, totally lived-in, relaxed-fit performance in the same movie, or to Delroy Lindo in Sinners for painting the richest and fullest portrait in that movie of a life lived. His Delta Slim is the only character in that movie who is old. He is both a musical prodigy and an old black man in Mississippi in 1932, someone whose circumstances never even gave him a dream of a way to share his talent and be rewarded for it, now reduced to playing his harmonica on street corners for coins to buy moonshine with. In every scene, you feel the decades crushing his shoulders down. Maybe I would have gone for Lindo, since his appearance in Sinners was both his first major movie role in a long time and a reminder that he is in fact getting old, and we should cherish him while we've still got him. Speaking of old men, Stellan Skarsgård was also exceptional in sentimental value, playing a very familiar kind of low-impact narcissist that almost never shows up in dramas because he's not splashy enough. But Penn? Come on. Do Academy voters actually find a Napoleon complex interesting? You like all those little twitches and grunts? Best Adapted Screenplay, Paul Thomas Anderson for One Battle After Another. I spent 8,000 words on this movie last fall, and probably a good 5,500 of them were an extended attack on Anderson's confused treatment of its source material, Pynchon's Vineland. But I forgot about this for a moment when I realized that, even though it was a writing award for an artist whose greater talent by far is for directing, this was Anderson's first Oscar win across 14 nominations spread over 28 years. The next thing I realized was that among the other nominees in this category, the only one in the same league as One Battle After Another was Begonia. Can you imagine if this had gone to Train Dreams or Hamnet? I would have been haunted by the kind of grief that haunts the characters in the single dimensions of reality in which those stupid movies take place. The fifth nominee was Frankenstein. I guess among all qualifying 2025 films, my actual favorite adapted screenplay was probably what Ira Sachs thought to do with Peter Hujar's Day, but I'm okay with Anderson getting this one. Among the movies of 2025, there were exactly two that were enormous cultural phenomena, and this was the one major category in which those two movies weren't in direct competition, so voters didn't have to choose. Which brings us to Best Original Screenplay, Ryan Coogler for Sinners. Sinners is a mess because Coogler has more ideas than can be reconciled, and is too excited about all of them to let go of any. But it's a bigger mess on the screen than it is on the page. Humorously enough, I think that Coogler, unlike Anderson, is a better writer than a director, so I guess we can justify this win on that basis if we're looking for one. The intentions of the story shine out more clearly from the page. But it's still muddled in its execution, and I don't just mean the filmmaking here, I mean the writer's job of bringing his ideas forth and joining them in a satisfying narrative. Refer to my previous comment about popular art these days being rewarded on the basis of what it attempts rather than what it achieves. What Sinners attempts is pretty cool, it's just that it doesn't really achieve it. I would probably have given this award to Jafar Panahi for It Was Just an Accident, but as it is with Paul Thomas Anderson, though not exactly in the same way, Panahi's screenplays don't give you half a sense of the films they will become. Both artists' work is really born to the screen. So on that basis, I might have voted instead to recognize Robert Kaplow's traditional and deeply satisfying script for Blue Moon, which is good in the kinds of ways that used to be commonplace in our grandparents' days, i.e. the days in which the movie takes place. Best Production Design, Tamara Deverell with set decorator Shane Vio for Frankenstein. Ugh, this is twice the disgrace that the wins for costume design and hair and makeup were. The sets of GDT's Frankenstein look not just natively digital, but like they were copied over from some low-rent streaming game. This one absolutely should have gone to Jack Fisk for Marty Supreme. This is the award that that movie most clearly deserved to win. Best Visual Effects, Avatar Fire and Ash. Okay, fine. That's all the movie is, and the reason it exists. Is anyone going to say it doesn't deserve it? Is it worth the breath? Best Documentary Short, All the Empty Rooms. This was the one about the school shooting victims whose bedrooms are left intact by their parents. I can't really say anything against this movie. It made me cry. Best Documentary Feature, Mr. Nobody Against Putin. I have not seen this movie, or any of the other four movies nominated against it. This is a total dereliction of duty on my part, for which I beg forgiveness. I had this one picked as the winner based on title alone, though. Being against dictators is in fashion right now, for some reason. Also, unlike the other four nominees, this one is currently playing in Portland. I will go see it. Maybe you'll find out what I think. Best Original Score, Ludwig Göransson for Sinners. Among the movies nominated in this field, Sinners is the one about music, and it's American music, so the score has twangy guitar in it, and Academy voters love all these things. Also, Sinners was among the 2025 movies with major heat and the most nominated film in Oscar history, so Sinners fever probably was a factor here. I had for some reason thought that One Battle After Another fever was going to put Johnny Greenwood over the top, and didn't talk through the above arguments with myself until 2 seconds after Göransson's name was announced. I'm not wild about Göransson's score work, and certainly not compared to Greenwood's, but it's serviceable Hollywood stuff, and on that level 100 times preferable to the moronic devices of an Alexandre Desplat, who composed the co-nominated score for Frankenstein. Best Sound, F1. I mean, duh. In purely technical terms, and now that the Sound Awards have been rolled up into one, has any film ever deserved this more? Best Editing, Andy Jurgensen for One Battle After Another. Another craft award that I think One Battle After Another has a perfectly fair claim on. I had thought Steven Mirioni's work on F1 would win, owing purely again to technical heft. But the dialogue scenes in that film were not cut with appropriate patience, though this could easily have been the fault of director Joseph Kosinski, who may well have doomed Mirioni by demanding that the momentum be artificially juiced at all times, or by not giving him good footage or good guidance to work with, or all of the above. I myself might have given this one to Marty Supreme, which was cut by Josh Softy and Ronald Bronstein, and well. But Jurgensen's work on One Battle After Another is also excellent. In fact, it's unimpeachable. He gives the movie a lot of its rhythm, which, especially but not exclusively during the oceanic car chase, are where many of its charms dwell. No quarrel here. Best Cinematography, Autumn Derald Arkhipov for Sinners. Quarrel time. Here's where I enter full jerkwad territory, so please ready the tomatoes. Arkhipov became the first woman and the first black artist ever to win Best Cinematography, and she could not have been more gracious, and that is great. That is all great. And the whole world seemed to erupt in celebration at this social watershed, and of course I will always join in the celebration when such a wall is knocked down. But what I was not able to do was look past the thing where Sinners is possibly the worst-lit movie ever to win this award. There are past winners in living memory that took an aesthetic tack that I found objectionable, like the Thomas Kincaid plastic fantasyland extravaganza that Robert Richardson unleashed on Martin Scorsese's Hugo in 2011. But what plagues Arkhipov's work in Sinners is something much more basic, and I would have thought objective. Everyone and everything is draped in shadow. You can't see the actors' faces. In certain night scenes, you can't even see what the characters are doing. As I mentioned in my review last year, bad lighting is arguably the single worst problem that a movie can have, insofar as when you can't see what's going on in a movie, whatever riches it may hold become a lot harder to get hold of. I don't know what else I can say on the matter. May Arkhipov continue to work and get better. Best International Feature, Sentimental Value. It was already obvious that the winner in this category would be either Sentimental Value or The Secret Agent, because of math. Among the five nominees, those were the only two that were also nominated for Best Picture. But even setting aside my personal opinion that The Secret Agent was the best movie of 2025, I genuinely thought it had the better shot at this award than Sentimental Value did. Not because it's the richer drama and the superior spectacle, but because of its political cachet. Remember what I said about it being fashionable to stand up to dictators? The Secret Agent is a nakedly anti-authoritarian movie, just as the movie that actually won Best Picture is. And I kind of assumed that it had earned its nominations on that basis. But between this and the tame Scandinavian family drama, the Academy chose to honor the latter. Sentimental Value is the kind of platonically ideal foreign film that won this award routinely for decades, alternating years with films from and about war-torn hellholes. But now the country responsible for creating most of those hellholes is crashing out, and those kinds of urgent political stories, for which The Secret Agent is a much closer match, should theoretically start to mean something more immediate to Americans. I'm scratching my head over the Academy going for the Diet Bergman instead. But Joachim Trier, the director and co-writer of the winning film, gave a lovely speech paraphrasing James Baldwin by saying, "All adults are responsible for all children," which did a fine job tying the theme of his movie to this politically urgent moment, a connection which he iced a second later by saying, "Let's not vote for politicians who don't take this seriously." Hard to take issue with that. Best Original Song, Golden, from K-pop Demon Hunters. This was foregone, I think, because besides being something of a banger, Golden was the first nominated song in a great while to actually cross over and become a smash pop hit. Honestly, I think this win was probably the surest bet of the entire night. And maybe this is what emboldened the producers of the show to cut three of the other four song performances. But that's still kind of unfair, don't you think? If you need to cut the show for time because, e.g., you have a whole new category being introduced this year, then okay, I can see dispensing with the live performances of the nominated songs, since original songs are not nearly as big a part of movies as they used to be, and the Academy probably has reams of data backing that up. But how do you let yourself cut only some of the songs? I further realize that the TV audience is not the voting body here, plus who on earth wants to hear another late-career Diane Warren song, least of all one that she wrote for a documentary about herself. But you have to admit that this programming change does dispel some of the award drama, because it makes it extremely prematurely clear which three songs are definitely not going to win in that category. Can you imagine being one of the other nominated songwriters? Well, not Diane Warren, but maybe the guy who wrote the song for Train Dreams, and getting a phone call from an Oscars producer who tells you, "We're cutting your song from the show for time because everybody already knows you're not going to win." Best Director, Paul Thomas Anderson for One Battle After Another. Again, I have my quibbles with One Battle After Another and with PTA as a writer, but as a director, he's one of his generation's boldest talents and hardest workers. And apart from his dependably disappointing choice to indulge once again his weakness for screaming, One Battle After Another is beautifully directed. The car chase is enough of a marvel on its own to make the movie last as a text for storyboarding and montage, but the pace and rhythm of the film is as brilliantly controlled over the long haul. And besides the fact that Anderson was the most deserving nominee in his field this year, he also joins great company by the fact that the movie which finally brought him Oscars was nowhere near one of his best. Best Actor, Michael B. Jordan for Sinners. Okay, I would have given this to Wagner Moura in The Secret Agent, but that's a pipe dream. I'm just glad he got nominated and is certain to get a lot more work now. I thought the likeliest winner in this category was Leo, especially after PTA's director win started making it look like One Battle After Another was going to edge out Sinners for Best Picture. I have loved Michael B. Jordan in almost everything, and especially in Ryan Coogler's first two movies, Fruitvale Station and Creed, both of which are exceptional dramas that rest 90% of their weight on Jordan's shoulders because they know they can. What's unfortunate about Sinners is that it's not very well directed compared to those two, and the way this touches Jordan's work is that the distinctions between the two twin brothers that he plays are not really inhabited, so the movie ends up heaping too much on the superficial differences in their appearances and the big flashing signs written into their competing personalities. I completely dismiss the voices that have been campaigning for Jordan to win this award by harping on the basic fact that he plays two characters, or even three if you think about it, since one of the brothers becomes a vampire. Again, awards are supposed to honor achievements, not efforts. It's the supporting cast of Sinners that is where its acting strength lies, Delroy Lindo and Wunmi Mosaku specifically. But as it was with PTA winning for One Battle After Another, this might not be Jordan's best work, but he is one of the best. So let's be happy for him and get excited to see what he will do next. He's not even 40 yet. Best Actress, Jessie Buckley in Hamnet. Like so many young actors in this blighted period, Jessie Buckley is a great talent who has never been in a movie that wasn't terrible, such that her abilities can only be detected upon squinting through a dense murk. Hamnet gave her just about the most insultingly shallow character any actress could ever dread being punished with, and I think she did the most graceful job she could have been asked to do with it, despite and not because of her awful director, Chloe Zhao. That said, was Buckley honored for her grace, for the quiet moments? No, she was honored for her screaming and crying, which Academy voters know as the highest form of acting. I would have given this one to Rose Byrne in If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You, which was a role that actually demanded some range and some negotiation of inner contradictions. But again, that kind of thing is all well and good, but it's nowhere near as difficult as screaming. Best Picture, One Battle After Another. Everything I said about PTA's earlier two wins can be applied to this one. I am fine with this. If I were to rank the last 10 winners of the Best Picture Oscar, One Battle After Another would land smack in the middle. I will note one thing that was kind of painfully amusing in Anderson's acceptance speech, though. He read the list of the 5 nominees for Best Picture in 1975 as an extremely generous and well-intentioned way of reminding us that greatness in movies can take an infinity of forms. His exact words were, "None of those movies is better than the others." But when he rattled off that list of movies, Dog Day Afternoon, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Jaws, Nashville, and Barry Lyndon, I doubt I was the only movie lover watching whose primary reaction was not a broader appreciation of the different paths that a movie can take to greatness, but acute depression at how far the entire medium has fallen in the past 50 years. My theme music is by me and Johann Wagner. My logo design is by Aaron Robert Miller. Find more than 1,000 of my reviews and writing at letterboxd.com/QUILLH. I'm Will Hatman, and I'll keep watching if you do.